This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Tonight we have quite an interesting show coming.
We do have a very interesting show. Associate Professor Jane Tomney is joining us.
To talk contact tracing.
Contact tracing, that's
now,
right.
Now, what is contact tracing, you might ask?
Yes.
It's when you've got an STI.
Yes.
Telling people.
Yep.
Who you've been with.
Trying to track down the guy you were with a couple of weeks ago who may have got given you something.
Yep. And look, the gays aren't very good at it, let's be honest.
Yeah.
They're not. They suck at it. Really suck. So we're going to talk about contact tracing and the importance of contact tracing, how contact tracing has changed in the past, 20, 30 years.
I can imagine it's going to be quite different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, okay, if I did get something right now, could I contact the people in the last 2 months?
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not.
No.
And that is a public health problem.
Exactly. So, we're going to be talking about that. So, you know, get in touch, get engaged during the program.
Mm.
In the studio joining us is Associate Professor Jane Tomney, who is the director at the Centre for Excellence in Rural Sexual Health. Good evening,
Jane.
Good evening,
Jane.
Good evening.
Now, we've brought you in because you are an experienced contact tracer. You've been doing contact tracing for a very long time, not so much anymore. Can you just explain to us exactly what contact tracing is and why it's so important?
Sure. So contact tracing is a public health tool that's been used for probably about 100 years.
Wow.
It's used in Victoria mostly now to contact anybody who has been in contact with somebody with an infectious disease. Mm-hmm. Particularly when we're talking about sexual health, we contact the sexual partners of people who are diagnosed with sexually transmissible infections. And also when we think about HIV or other bloodborne viruses, we contact sexual partners and any partners that might have shared some injecting equipment with those patients.
Are there specific rules around which infectious diseases need to be contactable? So HIV would be one, I presume.
Correct, yeah.
And what other sort of ones would you be required to, or the GP required to contact somebody?
Right. So contact tracing is not a legal requirement in Victoria.
Okay.
So it's a public health tool to try to minimise the ongoing transmission of an infectious disease. The infections that are most commonly contact traced in Victoria, HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea and chlamydia.
Okay. So the big ones.
Yeah.
Yep.
So those that have, it doesn't work very well if the infection is very, very prevalent in a community because your chances of finding somebody who's infected is almost always with something. If you think about something like human papylomavirus, people have been in contact.
Something like a herpes virus, one of the herpes viruses.
Yeah. So common cold sore or something like that.
Yeah.
And it also depends on what impact the infection might have for a partner and also for the public health and also whether or not it's curable or treatable.
Okay.
So I guess contact tracing now is probably a little bit different to what it used to be. We'll talk about what it used to be maybe a little bit later, but so how important is contact tracing now in this day and age?
So contact tracing's probably one of three very, very important elements when we think about public health control of sexually transmissible infections and bloodborne viruses. And the three main strategies that we have to try to contain these infectious diseases are good education, good clinical services, so good access to testing and to treatment, and that people have that free access that they can get treatment that is non-judgmental and accessible to them. And then the third thing is contact tracing. So contact tracing still plays a very big role in trying to maintain the inadvertent or unknown transmission, forward transmission of the infection.
It must be very difficult nowadays, though, because I can jump on an app and hook up with somebody and not have any contact details, like no phone numbers, no emails. They can delete their profile straight away. It must be very difficult nowadays for that to happen.
Yes, I think that it does, particularly for men who have sex with men. I think that it is the proportion of partners that are non-contactable or untraceable is possibly, it's hard to know because it's a unknown quantity.
Yeah.
So really, contact tracing relies, number one, on the goodwill of the person who's been diagnosed with the sexually transmissible infection. Because if you think about it, they're the only person in the world who knows who they've had sexual contact with.
Yeah.
So
most of the time.
Yes. So that person, there's always been particular partners that people, for whatever reason, might feel uncomfortable or may not be able to trace because they don't have enough information about the partner.
Sure.
But certainly, looking at 2014 versus 1986, 87 when I started, I think the proportion of people who are uncontactable or untraceable is probably greater today than it was then.
Yep. Now, speaking of back then and being unable to contact trace people, I guess is the equivalent of perhaps Grindr or apps these days, the equivalent of perhaps going to a beat back in the 80s where, you know, it's completely anonymous.
Yeah. Although I recently had a look at this very question, preparing a talk for an international conference. And I think even when people said to us before that their partner was anonymous or non-contactable, when we interviewed the patient and asked the right questions, sometimes there would be enough information to be able to find the person. So you may not know their name, you may not know who they are, phone number, anything like that, but you might know what that man looked like and that he visits a particular beat every Thursday night.
Yeah.
This is the sort of car that he drives. You know, we would spend many a long hour sitting outside beats. not myself. I wouldn't go in, but my colleague, who was a very out and proud gay man, we would sit and we would wait and we would look for a person who fit the right description, and, you know, we'd get as much information as we possibly could from our patient, and sometimes we could contact those people. And the same in Club 80, the same in the saunas. We did the same sort of thing.
You'd hunt through the saunas.
I knew the owner at Porter Street quite well. I used to have coffee there, but only when it wasn't open to customers. Yeah, I didn't go in when it was open to customers.
So you're saying it was really a case that you'd go, like, for a beat, for example, you would actually drive down there and sit in the car and wait and sort of see who's coming in and out?
On occasions, yeah. Particularly when we felt that we had enough to be able to really identify a person, and also depending on what the infection was.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So if it was something, I remember distinctly looking for a very young man who our patient thought was probably a married man who had regular sex with other men at beats on a particular night.
Yeah.
There was a child seat in the back of the car and so on. He was a young man, and our patient had been diagnosed with primary syphilis and with HIV recently. And so we thought it was very important for this young man to at least be alerted to the fact that he may have been in contact with those infections to get treated or to get tested.
Yeah. And you found him.
We did find him, and we did subsequently test him, and we tested our patients out in the field, so we're all registered nurses, and we could take blood and
so on.
So we took his blood in the back of the car and took it off to the laboratory, and then we're able to give him a result.
Because that would be really important, I imagine, because the fact of being confronted at that point in time obviously raise a whole range of risks.
Really, yeah.
But getting that person then to go the next day to a clinic is not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the really important thing that we always tried very carefully to remember, that the partners of our patients that we were tracing were not in a situation where you and I would be, where perhaps if we thought that we were at risk of a sexually transmissible infection, we could process that through our psyche.
Sure.
We could book into whichever doctor we wanted to see. Mm-hmm. We could go along, you know, that you do all that process yourself. These patients, these partners were just being given the information there on the spot unexpectedly by health department officials.
Yeah.
And so often
that'd
we
be
would
terrifying
spend,
because you're doing something that you shouldn't, that you're doing in secrecy anyway. And then to find someone, well, a couple of government officials coming up to you going, "Oh, hello, we know what you're doing here. We need to talk to you." that'd be quite confronting for them.
And we were very careful. We would think about things like, as you can see today, I dress in a pair of jeans and a T-shirt, my colleague the same. We were very keen, and we fought very hard within the health department to have government cars that had a standard license plates on them and not those red
not
government
the red ones,
plates.
You know,
we didn't go in white coats and stethoscopes. so we tried to blend in, and we thought about, there was a team of three of us, and we thought about who would be the best person to contact that partner. So if we were looking for a 15-year-old woman, a 15-year-old girl, we wouldn't send Tom, who was a 40-year-old man, to the front door to her parents' home, and vice versa. I was very cautious. I'm a female. I was very careful about not intruding, particularly for men who have sex with men, into gay men's venues or places where they might be socialising or meeting other partners, and being very respectful, trying to be very respectful about stepping into a place that it would be very obvious that I didn't quite fit in.
It just blows my mind that that's the kind of, you know, that's what happened back then. Like, but also I love how the fact that you said was, you know, we're not going, I guess you weren't going to sit outside a public toilet looking for someone who just got gonorrhea or something. Like, it was all very relative to what risk they'd been at.
True. And there were only three of us. We covered the whole of the state of Victoria.
Wow.
And I remember when I first started, I was in charge of looking after the syphilis notifications for the whole state of Victoria. And the first year I worked in this job, we had 14 syphilis notifications for the entire year.
Right.
So it was a lot different than it is today. Smaller numbers. And we still had about 200 new HIV infections every year, and we spoke to every single person who was diagnosed and asked them if we could help them let their partners know.
Hide and seek.
This is your program for exploring sex, sexuality and self. Andrew the Apprentice and James Finlay are talking about sex and sexuality quite a bit tonight with Associate Professor Jane Tomney, who has a long
history.
Has a history. I shouldn't say long. I shouldn't put a time frame on it, should I? has a history with contact tracing.
Now, one thing that I find really interesting that I think you might have an opinion on is the fact that when I'm diagnosed with an STI, and I think, it's like, oh, okay, I reckon it was about this long ago that I had sex with that person, and, oh, I kind of did that with this person and that with that, I reckon it might be that person. What's the probability of me actually being right?
Well,
I know the answer.
I can only say from my this is not based on any published evidence, I have to say, but it's
in
based,
your
it's based on 15 years of clinical experience. I guess that of all the hundreds and hundreds of partners that I traced, who, of course, we never, ever, ever told them who the index patient was. We didn't even say the gender of the index patient.
So the index patient being
the person who was diagnosed. Yep. So that's you in this case. So we wouldn't say it was a male or a female. We'd just say, we're here from the health department. We know that you've been at risk of whatever the STI or the sexually transmissible infection may be. And the first question partners always ask is, who is it?
Yeah.
And when was it? And of course, we gave them none of that information. And I'd say probably about 99% of the time they were wrong when they guessed who it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And particularly, I mean, I remember vividly a man saying to me, well, I know who it is because I've only had one sexual partner. And so by the time we had spent an hour with him and we interviewed him and spoken to him and had a cup of tea with him, we walked out the door and he could remember five sexual partners in the last 12 months that he'd, oh, I forgot about him. Oh, yes, I forgot about that night then and this time there. So, and he wasn't deliberately lying.
No.
He just didn't remember. But I think he'd done what you have just described, is he thought, okay, who do I think it most likely is? Mm. And then once people jump to that conclusion, they often just...
They forget about the rest.
Forget about the rest.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm taking it that conversation is a case whereby you say to not the index person but the other person, we understand you may have been in contact with someone who's at risk. That conversation, not a conversation of blame.
Oh, absolutely not. And of course, particularly in the early days of HIV, it was very difficult for partners to hear the news that they had had an unprotected sexual contact with somebody recently diagnosed with HIV. That was the line that we opened with. We'd never contact traced a partner where a condom had been used or we didn't think there was a risk of transmission. So only ever, and we only
That would cut down the workload.
Yes. And we only ever contact traced when we had a definitive laboratory diagnosis. So we knew somebody had definitely been diagnosed with HIV.
Yep.
We then asked them about their partners, only where they'd had unprotected sex, then went to the partner. Now, after that first question of who is it, the next question, sorry, I've just lost my train of thought.
But it's not a situation of blame.
Yeah, so that we would say to this, that when they'd say who is it, and we'd say we couldn't tell them, or in fact we didn't know, and so on. We would say, look, one thing that we can definitely tell you is somebody in this world cared enough about you and about your health to ask us to get in a car, often late at night or whenever it might be, drive to wherever we are now, person's home or their place of work, and to let you know that you may have been at risk so that you can have that information and you can deal with that as you want to look after your own health. And that was a very, very good way to diffuse people's anger. And when that still didn't work, we'd say, look, if you place yourself in the other person's position, they've just found out they've got HIV or they've just found out they've got gonorrhea or syphilis. And they've had to deal with that in their own life. And yet they've still been good enough to worry about you and let us know.
I think that's really important because I think perhaps this is one of the reasons why the gay community has such an issue with contact tracing and telling people in the past, you know, that you've got an STI. I don't think I've ever been told that a sexual partner of mine has had an STI yet. I've still come across them. I've told partners in the past, and I've been really lucky that I haven't had someone abusive, you know, tell me, oh, why, you know, what the hell, why have you given me this, blah, blah, blah. I think maybe one, I was like, well, look, I'm not playing blame here. Like, we don't know who gave each other what. But one of my friends has had a couple of experiences where they've, you know, called him a slut or a slurry and all these, like, names and things, which has been awful. He's like, and now he's terrified to tell other people, you know, and he's only just doing it out of the goodness of his own will. Well, I guess there is a way that people should be able to tell people, and there are ways that people can do this anonymously, right? Still today.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, people can. So that was one of the reasons why people would refer their partner's information across to us, was that then the index patient, the person diagnosed with the STI or HIV in the early days particularly, so they wouldn't have to breach their own privacy or confidentiality. They didn't have to say who they were. But you're absolutely right. One of the key things that we always said to partners is just because someone is diagnosed first doesn't mean that they're the person who had the infection first. Yes. And we always say to partners and to patients, we know one thing for sure in this world. You can't have a sexually transmissible infection on your own. There's always at least one other person. And whether or not you might have passed it on or whether they gave it to you doesn't matter. We will never know. It's just around looking after people's health.
So just clarify something for me there. It's a case of you could anonymously put your name essentially into a database, I guess, in some form, as the index person, and that would then provide you with not all the information about the index person as you're going to that other partner.
So we never ever ask the index patient to ever record their information anywhere than with their diagnosing doctor.
Yep.
So we would contact every single doctor or health professional in Victoria who had a new diagnosis of a person with a new diagnosis of an STI or HIV. So every single time, by law, they had to notify under code, didn't use people's names, and then we would call the doctor back. We'd say, doctor, we understand you have a patient.
Code 5678.
You know, number one, how's the person going? Yep. Number two, do you need any help with their care and treatment and referrals? And number three, have you talked to them about their partners? How are they going? do you have information about the partner? So the patient had the option of either telling their doctor as much as they knew about the partner and then the doctor passing it on to us.
Yep.
So that we didn't, and that was the best way to do it. That way we didn't have to say to the partners, we don't know who the index patient is, because we truly didn't.
You didn't know. Yeah.
Occasionally then, if it was a gay man, and particularly when mobile phones became very popular, and gay men would say, or men who had sex with men would say, oh yes, I've got a whole lot of names and phone numbers in my phone. We thought all our Christmases would come at once, because then the doctor would say, is it okay for the contact tracers to contact you directly? And then with the patient's permission, they would hand over the index patient's details and we'd interview them.
The old little black book.
Oh, became a little mobile phone.
Yeah.
Oh, we loved those days.
You guys must have loved, but even, oh no, I
did
can remember.
Did people leave black book, have black
books?
Yes.
I can remember having friends who had their book.
Yes.
And obviously then the mobile phone. So that must have been a lot easier. Particularly when they, you know, because some people get a bit OCD around it and mark off who's been when and all that sort of stuff as well.
Correct, yes.
Oh, and my God.
Yeah, very true. And some people colour-coded and were able to do ratings and we weren't that interested in that side of the thing.
Sure. No, but, you know.
But mobile phones as well, the partners became far more contactable because when I first started, we were the very first bureaucrats in the health department to have a mobile phone. The battery lasted less than an hour. It was charged all night.
Oh my God.
And we had to find people face to face because nobody had a mobile phone.
No. Yeah.
And then when they had mobile phones, people would pick them up during the day or people would answer them. So we didn't have to wait till they came home from work. And our working hours became far less once mobile phones really took off in the sort of the
less stalking beats.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. Much easier to ring a phone number.
Yeah.
Joy 94.9.
You're on Hide and Seek with James Finlay and Andrew the Apprentice, and we are with Associate Professor Jane Tomney, and we are speaking of contact tracing.
Contact tracing, which is in case you have an STI and you need to let somebody else know about it.
Go through your Grindr history or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Go through
your phone history.
Your phone history. And, you know, let the Department of Health know, and they can get in touch with the partner and let them know.
Which is quite serious when it comes to, you know, HIV and syphilis. It's very important to contact the people that you've had sexual contact with.
Correct, yes.
Hmm. Now, we spoke a little bit about the stigma that is attached with having an STI, you know, because a lot of people are fearful that they might cop abuse if they tell someone, a sexual partner, that they've come across an STI and that they should probably get checked. One of my favourite times, actually, was when I got an STI and I told all of the four people, four people that I'd had contact with that they should go and get checked, and every one of them came back to me and said, oh, thanks for that, it wasn't
me.
All clean. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Nothing. Nope. I got all clear. All clear. Got nothing. I'm like, oh, all four of you. Great. Okay. One of you lying. but there is a little bit of stigma attached. And when you were, Jane, when you were on the, well, I was going to say on the beat. It's a little bit double entendre there. But when you were on the ground searching for people who you need to contact to tell them that they had contact with an STI. I understand it would be a little bit weird if you came across this person in a non-beat environment accidentally.
Or a non-work setting.
Yeah, non-work setting, yeah.
Yes. It was always one of the things that we always said to the patients and to the partners is, if I ever meet you again, for whatever reason ever, other than to do this job, then I will never, ever let anybody know that I've ever met you previously. Mm-hmm. So it will be your responsibility to approach me and say hello if you'd like to and you want to have a chat.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I won't approach you because I think we became quite well known in the gay community and people knew that those that were seen talking to us were either a very good friend of my colleagues or might have been in contact with someone with an STI or HIV. So they So we certainly definitely left that to the patients to make that decision. But I remember being in the candlelight vigil marches in the very early years, and just in the end having to march with my eyes looking just down at the road, because meeting people's eyes and there'd be recognition of the work that we'd done previously with them. And people were fearful, or people were very, very worried about being, even though if their friends knew that they'd been in contact with me or one of my colleagues, that they had been at risk of HIV. But of course, you know, then nobody knew what the result of their test was, because of course not every single partner that you contact trace is positive. Yeah. In fact, most aren't. So, you know, people were worried that they would be stigmatized, that they were either positive or that they weren't positive or whatever it might have been in those very early days. And so it was better not to know us, I think.
But things have changed a little bit now.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think people are...
So nowadays, what's your understanding of how it works nowadays, and how's it different nowadays? If I needed to do it now, how would I go about it?
So there's two main ways that people do contact tracing. One is what we've been talking about tonight, and we call that provider referral. That's where a health professional does it on your behalf. The most common way that people do it is what we call patient referral, where the patient does it themselves. They let their partners know themselves.
Sure.
And so the big difference today for me, being the old person that I am, is that in the early days when we did this work, particularly in HIV, we had nothing really to offer to patients. These days it's a lot different, because contact tracing somebody for HIV today is letting them know, look, you've been in contact, the person can go and get a test, then they've got many options around what they want to do with those with their result. If they're diagnosed with HIV infection, then do they want to start treatment, do they not want to start treatment, do they want to, you know, there's a whole lot of things. Or even to the point where if somebody is contact traced and the sexual contacts only happened the night before or a couple of nights before, then, you know, they may even be still within that window where they can get access to NPEP. So, you know, it's a heck of a lot different today than it was in the mid to late 80s, where people really didn't have any option. And we did contact tracing purely from a public health perspective, and that was to prevent people inadvertently or unknowingly transmitting an infection. And if you think about most of the sexually transmissible infections, most are asymptomatic. That's why we do contact tracing, because people don't know that they have them.
And particularly nowadays, in regards to HIV in particular, you've got ample opportunity to know your own status, and therefore to negate the need to be worrying about contact tracing potentially.
Correct. So if you contact a partner of somebody to say, look, you've been at risk of HIV or of an STI, and the person's being regularly tested or regularly screened, then they know what their own sexual history has been in that short period of time since their last test.
It can bring you back down to, you don't have to worry about the last 2 months or whatever.
Yeah, or the last couple of weeks if you've had a test in the last few weeks. So, yes, so that makes it much easier. And can I just add, James, from something that you were saying earlier around how it feels to do contact tracing, the evidence and the published literature worldwide, there's been many studies, and I'm currently undertaking a study at the moment and interviewing men who have sex with men in Melbourne who are diagnosed with HIV, to talk to them about what their experience of partner notification or contact tracing was. But the published literature tells us very clearly that the thing that patients tell us the most loudly is that the experience, once it's done, was never as bad as what they thought it was going to be. And in fact, you know, getting those, you know, very, what they would, fearful responses from a partner are very, very few and far between. Yeah. And in fact, most people are very grateful that you've at least cared enough to let them know.
And sure, it's a little bit embarrassing, but you can get over that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as we've already said tonight, we don't know who's placed who at risk, and so people are just often grateful that they at least know.
And you can't have an STI by yourself.
Exactly.
I like that line. And just as we're wrapping things up, you are, of course, the director at the Centre for Excellence in Rural Sexual Health. Is there a big difference between rural communities and metro communities in this space, or is it? one theory could be that it's easier in a rural community potentially because there's a smaller network.
But then it also could be harder because everyone knows each other.
Yes. Exactly. And that, and you both like to come and work at the Centre for Excellence in Rural Sexual Health because you hit the nail on the head.
Exactly.
That they in rural communities we have what we call we don't have lots of weak ties, which people who live in big metropolitan cities do. So you us sitting here today, we'd have lots of people who we know as acquaintances that we would say hello to, maybe even have a cup of coffee with occasionally if you happen to run into them, but not people that you know very well. People who live in smaller rural communities don't have those acquaintances as such. No. They tend to have people that they know very, very well, or people that they don't associate with.
Yeah.
And so, as you say, that can be very easy to know who you've had sex with, but it also can be very difficult, and particularly for young same-sex attracted people as well as young heterosexual people. They get very, very concerned that their reputation within their small communities are extremely important, and if they're tarnished or damaged in any way, then that's a real worry for young people particularly, and others.
Yeah. Of course.
Associate Professor Jane Tomney, the Director of the Centre for Excellence in Rural Sexual Health, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.